This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Bill Stenger had talked about massive economic development plans for the Northeast Kingdom for years before it all came crumbling down last week with federal and state allegations of fraud. Back in September of 2012, Stenger announced a $500 million economic development project that he said would generate 10,000 jobs in the Northeast Kingdom by attracting foreign investors.
Today is not so much about Jay Peak, but it is about taking a program we have proven effective here and expanding its value to our surrounding community.
The bold plan included new facilities at Burke Mountain and Jay Peak and a biotech facility in Newport. Here's Stenger just a year ago promoting that biotech project, ANC Bio.
There are a tremendous number of reasons why living and working in our part of Vermont has value. Safe, clean, environmentally beautiful, a facility that's state-of-the-art and debt-free.
That debt-free promise sounds ominous now. At the time, Stenger and his business partner, Ariel Quiros, said most of the funding for ANC Bio and the other projects would come from foreign investors using a visa program called EB-5. The program provides a path to a green card for wealthy foreign investors and their families who invest a minimum of $500,000 in a new business that creates at least 10 jobs. But behind the scenes, the investment funds supporting those projects were allegedly being siphoned off. Last week, state and federal regulators announced that Stenger and Quiros are responsible for fraudulently spending $200 million. The allegations are that they used new investor money to pay off previous projects and, in the case of Quiros, that he used investor money to enrich himself. It's a setup that federal regulators called a Ponzi-like scheme. State regulators announced their own lawsuit against Stenger and Quiros on Thursday. The state's investigation and allegations were led by the Department of Financial Regulation, and the commissioner of that department is our guest today. Susan Donegan, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you.
When did you first start looking into Stenger and Quiros' dealings with the EB-5 program and start suspecting fraud?
Well, in early 2015, DFR began to focus on the Jay Peak properties. I think people know by now that DFR was asked to join with the Agency of Commerce and Community Development to provide heightened scrutiny on all of the EB-5 projects. We began with the Jay Peak projects in part because the principals asked us to consider allowing them to raise more money for the Q Burke hotel project as well as for the ANC Bio Clean Room project. So as part of that request, we started to look at the financial documents and do a financial review and also get a better understanding of what the disclosures were that were being given to investors about the risks and the actual use of the money. So that was in early 2015. Pretty quickly, DFR saw that there were unusual transactions. There were anomalies in some of the financial statements that weren't making much sense to us. It raised our regulatory concerns when there wasn't a great deal of cooperation from the projects.
And when you say that, do you mean from Stenger and Quiros?
Yes,
or others as well?
As others. I mean, it's just not those two gentlemen, but there were a lot of other folks involved. You know, when you're a regulator, one of the red flags that you get is when you have folks that don't want to cooperate with you. So it gave us pause to look a little bit deeper and spend some time understanding what some of the strategies were. We needed to get our arms around what the projects were about. We were new to the game, and we wanted to make sure that all the investor money across all the projects were being deployed properly. So by February 2015, and we're kind of going in a quick timeline right now, those concerns prompted us to take closer look at some of the financials. We went to financial institutions and asked for accounts. We needed to track where money was going. We wanted to get a real clear idea. And again, almost immediately, we saw that there were some unusual things going on. By March of 2015, I had, with my securities division and my legal folks at DFR, decided that an internal investigation was appropriate. So we started to do what I would call a more formal investigation. That meant that by April, we started to send out subpoenas to financial institutions to gather documents. You know, the kind of case this is one where you spend a great deal of time putting a very large puzzle together with a lot of little pieces. And when you have 100 bank accounts and brokerage accounts over 10 institutions over years and years, you can imagine why, when I say we wound up with about 300,000 documents to review, that's not a joke.
And I should say, on the Vermont Edition page for today's show, you can see what you've been calling the spaghetti chart of where the money went and how it was all distributed. I mean, it is like a many tentacled squid out there, just based on this chart that you've created. So you can go to vpr.net to see that, but just as an illustration of what you're talking about.
Yeah, we saw a complex web of financial accounts that we allege facilitated the improper commingling and misuse of funds, and those went between the projects themselves as well as between personal accounts and other related accounts. You know, if people look at that chart, and that's also on our DFR website, each colored box is a financial account, and then the spaghetti lines are the route that the money took in and out of various accounts that were controlled by Mr. Stenger, Mr. Quiros, and some of the related entities.
So now we're getting into a little bit of what you're alleging, and what the suit alleges. So give us the sort of bullet points of what the state is charging.
Well, we allege that Mr. Quiros and Mr. Stenger, through the EB-5 projects themselves, as well as various related companies and their personal accounts, misused more than $200 million of investor funds intended for the EB-5 development projects up in the Northeast Kingdom.
And these are seven projects that investors thought they were helping to fund.
There's seven projects that are within the lawsuit itself, but then there's also the Kew Burke Hotel, which is a standalone issue. So the case also alleges that Mr. Quiros misappropriated an additional $50 million of investor funds for his own personal use. And we saw that those funds were unlawfully diverted, not only among projects, but for things such as purchasing an apartment at Trump Place in New York City for his personal use, millions of dollars to pay back income taxes and other personal expenses, and also $20 million to purchase Jay Peak and the Kew Burke Resorts. Not something that we believe the investors had signed up for, and they certainly didn't understand the risks associated with that kind of activity.
That seems to be all money that Ariel Quiros was diverting. What's the role of Bill Stenger in this?
Without Bill Stenger's cooperation and his knowledge and his participation in moving the money and helping Mr. Quiros to move the money, we allege that these frauds would not have taken place as easily. So I think there's culpability on both sides, and that's certainly what we allege in the complaint.
Will anybody else be named in state complaints on this? I know you mentioned that when you were trying to get information, you were talking with other people as well. Are there other people that you think should be named or who are culpable?
Well, as we mentioned at the press conference, this is early in the legal matter, the litigation. Certainly, we've been having the investigation go on for over a year. So I think it's early to say whether or not there will be additional either defendants or other entities. Certainly, with hearing that the U.S. attorney is now taking a look at this, I think that people should expect that this will be a broader action at some point.
And the U.S. attorney looking into it, that's looking into it at a criminal level. So that would be investigating whether there should be any criminal complaints filed against anybody in these cases, because both the SEC complaint and the state's complaint are civil cases.
Civil fraud.
We do have a question from a listener who wants to know, will anybody be charged criminally in this? I believe it's Ray says, last week when the attorney general addressed this issue, civil charges were mentioned, but not criminal ones. Are we going to see people involved in a multimillion-dollar fraud walk away without having to do time for what they've done?
Well, as Attorney General Sorrell mentioned previously, he is not at this moment looking at criminal charges, but he was also very clear to say that's at this moment, and that those types of charges may be brought in the future. I can't speak for the U.S. attorney, so I don't know where they are in their investigation. Certainly, they will have to decide whether or not the conduct rises to the level of criminal behavior. And so I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody does at this point.
Is that something that your department has a hand in, or do you just leave that to the Attorney General?
We are a civil enforcement division.
We're talking today with Commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, Susan Donegan, about fraud allegations against Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros. If you have a question for her, or if you are involved in this situation, maybe you live or work in the Northeast Kingdom and have a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note, Commissioner Donegan, from a listener who is identifying him or herself as a Q Burke investor and says, investors relied on the state of Vermont for monitoring and to avoid fraud, but now feel failed at the 13th hour. The state was monitoring for a couple of years. Why were investors allowed to trust state regional supervision and allowed to make investments?
Well, you know, to be an investor, you have to be eligible for the U.S. citizenship program through EB-5. There are certain conditions and elements that must be met. So the immigrants' investment of capital, the $500,000 that folks put towards the investment, that has to be at risk. That's a term and a requirement that the federal government places on this program. It also has to invest in a new commercial enterprise. It also has to create jobs, as you mentioned earlier. So ACCD is a regional center. We're one of two in the country that's active. Michigan is the other one. We're also the only EB-5 center at this point that has a securities division that's in partnership with its regional center. So I absolutely understand the frustration and question that the listener has asked. But I would say to him or her that, you know, we've got a situation here where the state was involved in these programs. We do not promote them in the sense of telling you it's a good investment or not. That's what the private placement memorandum, those are the documents that the project itself issues to explain to investors what the risk is of the project, how the project is supposed to behave. And as long as those documents represent adequate disclosure, it is for a reasonable investor to decide whether or not they want to engage in the investment.
It was less than 2 years ago that your department took over the oversight of EB-5. And before that, it was with the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Do you think that was the wrong place for it, since the Agency of Commerce was essentially trying to boost commerce and jobs in the state and had the dual role of trying to oversee and promote?
Well, I think, first of all, we didn't take over that program. We are in partnership with ACCD, so they still are very much in the picture. And when the governor asked Pat Moulton, Secretary of ACCD, to meet with me and we could talk about how we should go forward with some enhanced oversight, one of the concerns we had was having everything in one pot over at ACCD. And let me tell you how we have some experience with this kind of format with ACCD on the captive insurance side. You know, ACCD promotes and markets captive insurance for us around the world and brings in good companies and leads, and then it's turned over to the regulators to actually make the determination as to whether a company is worthy of a Vermont license. So we were using that format as a way to think about how to form this partnership going forward, because it is difficult to be promoting something and then have to actually go and regulate it.
Given how quickly you uncovered signs of fraud or suspicious circumstances, should that have been done sooner?
You know, I think we all wish that things were done sooner. I mean, this is a devastating and shocking experience. But from the moment that we had the decision made and moved forward, I think we've moved pretty quickly.
Were you advocating for more oversight from your department prior to when you got it?
No, actually, I was not. I was asked to consider this the summer of 2015 when the governor asked Pat Moulton and me to talk about it.
The summer of 2015?
Sorry.
2014.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm getting
good.
My years mixed
good.
Up.
No,
right
just
now.
Checking because
yeah,
the timeline is confusing. And
yeah.
Perfect. So, and you took over at the very beginning of 2015. That's
yeah, you know, we executed a memorandum of understanding between the agency and the department about what this partnership would look like at December 2014. And so we we got on the job in January 15.
We're talking with Commissioner Susan Donegan, head of the Department of Financial Regulation, and we're looking at the state's suit against Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros alleging fraud, $200 million fraud. We got a note from another investor who says, investors like myself trusted that the Vermont state government would provide a level of oversight over J. Peek and Q. Burke. That's exactly why we chose to invest in your state. Kudos to Commissioner Donegan for working hard to reveal this fraud, but remember, not too long ago, Shumlin and Leahy were praising and endorsing those crooks, Quiros and Stenger, and now Shumlin wants to delete his emails? People of Vermont, hold your leaders accountable. Your hopes and dreams of economic development and new jobs were shattered by incompetent, corrupt bureaucrats in bed with thieves, just as they shattered my dream of immigrating to your country. We are going to talk a little bit more about oversight. We're going to talk more about what's actually in this lawsuit, and we're going to talk about what happens now for J. Peek and Q. Burke. They're in receivership. What does that actually mean, and how does it work? And if you have a question that you would like to share with Commissioner Donegan, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Commissioner Susan Donegan, head of the Department of Financial Regulation. We've been talking about how the state looked into allegations of fraud in the EB-5 investor program in the Northeast Kingdom. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 with your questions, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Patty in Wilder who says, who currently owns Burke Mountain and is in charge of running the ski resort?
Well, Burke Mountain, and you're talking, I think, about the actual mountain itself, has been owned by Mr. Quiros since he purchased it back in 2008. However, he is not running it. He is not, or Mr. Stenger, running any of the EB-5 projects right now. As part of the SEC's action, they asked federal court in Miami to do what's called a conduct injunction, which is to basically bar or remove those principals from any management or oversight for not only the Vermont projects, but any EB-5 project anywhere in the country. And that was granted. Now, the federal court has appointed a receiver. That's somebody who comes in and basically takes over the management with a very neutral, position of identifying assets, making sure if it's a going concern that the operations continues. So a receiver was appointed for the assets of the EB-5 projects. He has been ordered by the court to determine the amounts that could be owed to individual creditors, because there are folks up there who claim they are owed money for services, for certainly investors, and will at some point, with court supervision, decide how to distribute assets based on court order. And that information about if people want to follow that, but I think investors would want to follow that, will be forthcoming, because receivers normally put up their own websites and they give you a great deal of information about how to track the progress of that.
We've got a couple of notes here from listeners who are worried about the implications for the region. Brown Stain says, one quarter of downtown Newport looks like Syria. We will have no new hotel, no new airport terminal, no new window factory, no biofacility, no aircraft manufacturer. All we have is a hole. All false hopes promised by a pair of snake oil salesmen in an area where hope in the future is a rare commodity is gone. With the complicity of a state and local leadership that was either wowed by the bright lights or who were plain incompetent or involved in the scam or all of the above, due diligence and oversight by the people we elect to do just that was woefully inadequate. Another listener says, my fiancé and I have booked our wedding through Q. Burke after a tour of the facility, and we now have no idea how this is moving forward. We've heard rumblings of problems, and now last week everything seems to be coming out. The hotel is beautiful and the views are perfect. We were in love with the plans we had in our heads, but now we don't know if we want to follow through with it after these allegations have come to light. And then Michael says, in addition to receivership, what is the state doing to work with the receiver to ensure that Burke Mountain and Burke Hotel will open in time for ski season? So a lot of thoughts in there, Commissioner Donegan, but basically what happens now that these properties are in receivership for people who are either, you know, invested in weddings or invested because they live in the town or want to know if ski season can happen and some money can come into this region?
Well, these are good questions. They also show the level of concern, shock, some despair about what has been going on and what people now know about the Northeast Kingdom's projects. But I think that all is not lost. And the reason is that because there is a receiver on the scene, I mean, the prime job of a receiver is to preserve those assets. And so the receiver, and I have heard briefings from the receiver that his number one job is to keep the properties open and running, those that are already going concerns, and businesses that are, as we know, Jay Peak has got a ski season coming up, and there's the water park, and there's jobs, and there's weddings that have been booked up at Jay, that those should be just going forward seamlessly. I mean, that is the idea. You bring in a receiver who also has a professional hotel and management company under his direction that comes in, gets their arms around the operations, and keeps the thing running. It means that people are still going to their jobs. They've been told to report to their jobs. There's not going to be substantial layoffs. And that is an important part of what the state has been talking to the receiver about. The governor spoke with the receiver, and I listened in on that conversation too when the governor was telling us about his conversation, that keeping the Northeast Kingdom as close to operational as possible. Now, there are some projects that didn't get off the ground, and they may never. But I think that if people see what assets there are up there and that hopefully they understand that they're being managed and they're being attended to and they're not forgotten.
Let's go to Jeremy, who's calling in from West Newbury. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Hello. I've heard repeatedly the properties being referred to as belonging to Q Resorts and in the present tense. And given my understanding that the initial purchase of even Jay Peak, and this was after a warning from council from Mount St. Sever that EB-5 funds could not be used to purchase the mountain. Basically, every one of these purchases has been fraudulent. So when we still refer to ownership being that of Q Resorts, what's the bottom line in terms of as this goes into receivership? How does ownership and what mechanisms will, you know, basically play out from here in order to, you know, distribute ownership from Q Resorts to whoever is on the end of that line, I guess, is what I'm curious about.
Thanks for the call, Jeremy. Commissioner Donegan?
Well, there are several different entities to think about. One is actual assets that are owned by, at this point, they are owned by Mr. Quiros. There is also the projects themselves, the EB-5 projects, which are owned by the investors. And the receiver is now in stepping in the shoes of those investors and also taking supervision of the other assets that belong to Mr. Quiros and managing those. But ultimately, it will be the court's decision about who receives any possible money, that is, return of money for investors, whether or not Mr. Quiros gets to keep ownership of any of these assets. And you're right that the fraud allegedly began in the very beginning when the Jay Peak mountain was purchased with investor funds from the first and second projects. So we do have an ongoing fraud that started with absolutely the first purchase.
Well, on that, we have a note from Jay Peak Skier, who says, on this use of fraudulent funds to finance Quiros's purchase of Jay Peak, how does someone like Quiros obtain access to the financial accounts, the EB-5 funds of the selling firm or previous owner, before they actually own the company outright? This doesn't seem like it would be common practice to grant financial control to someone before they've closed on and paid for the acquisition. And Brad says, this is exactly the entry point for Kyros. And after reading the federal indictment, I have the same question. That must have been a very complex purchase and sale contract. Someone must have told him about MSSI's huge asset, the EB-5 money that had been raised before he bought Jay.
Well, the chronology is that the first two projects were actually created under the Canadian company. And there was no misconduct there in those original raising of EB-5 money by that Canadian company. In fact, Mr. Stenger worked for them. One of the principals of the Canadian company unfortunately died unexpectedly, and it made the company decide it wanted to refocus its strategy and be more focused in Canada. And so there was an interest in selling the projects, the the EB-5 projects of number one and number two. Mr. Stenger knew Mr. Kyros because he owned a condo up in that area and put the deal together. So it was the money that had already been raised by number one and number two project that was in escrow, dedicated to build those projects, was then moved over as part of the purchase price to escrow accounts that wound up into Mr. Kyros's brokerage account, and then we went the way to another account that had a different name and then another account, and then wound up basically being funneled back to the original Canadian owners as money that looked like something very different.
So you agree with the SEC's characterization of this whole thing as a Ponzi-like scheme?
There are Ponzi-like aspects to it. I mean, when you divert money right up front, you then start to see that the projects had to be backfilled. So you had to use new investor money to pay the debt or to pay the sort of the gap that you created from the first project. So yes, there are Ponzi-like aspects to it.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions we got from John, and he's got a sort of a list of a couple of very pointed questions. So Commissioner Donegan, he says, did you retaliate against any state employees for concerns they brought up regarding the EB-5 program?
No, I don't know what that means, but no.
I guess, I mean, my reading of that is anybody who came to you before the investigation or during the investigation and saying, I have concerns that something is amiss in the EB-5 program.
No, that's not true. We started on January 2015, and that's when I started with my staff.
He also asks, did your recent announcement to retire 2 weeks ago have anything to do with the EB-5 fraud or the SEC investigation?
Well, first of all, taking July and August off in Vermont and to experience our 20 minutes of summer is very tantalizing to me.
You are supposed to retire on June 30th,
I am supposed to. And retire is a relative term. I wish I could retire. No, there's no one reason why I decided to leave my post at this time, 5.5 years into it. There are many reasons personally and professionally, and it seemed like a good time to step down. Obviously, we got this thing launched before I moved on.
John asks, are you or the executive branch currently the target of any federal investigation?
Not that I have been aware of, no.
For either you or for Governor Shumlin or the executive branch?
I have no knowledge that we are a target of any investigation.
And did Peter Shumlin or anyone in the executive branch direct you or anyone in DFR or put pressure on you or your office to look the other way regarding the obvious fraud going on at the EB-5 projects?
Quite the opposite. I mean, one of the things that my experience of working with the governor is he's always supported me to do my job, whether it's been difficult or even controversial. So I've been told repeatedly over the years, Donegan, do your job. And I think if people think back to a couple of other big decisions I've had to make as commissioner, particularly when I denied the license of a proposed health insurance co-op a few years ago, that was a tough decision, not popular. But certainly the governor was behind me on that one. And I think we can see that that decision spared Vermont an inevitable and expensive company insolvency that many other states are experiencing right now. So I certainly, as an independent department, and DFR is one of three that's an independent department, I try to bring a very neutral eye. You know, bank accounts can't be influenced, and that's one of the good things about the kind of work that we do. It's very driven by facts, figures, and the law.
You mean they can't be influenced because the money's either in it or not in it?
You know, you see money going in an account. You see money coming out of an account. You can track that money. You can't influence that.
Let's go to Stephen calling in from Montreal. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Yes, hello. I'm a fond JP skier. Sad to hear what's going on. I'd like to know the evidence that you've gathered in the civil case. Well, can it be used in a criminal case, or do the criminal investigators have to start from scratch? And then the second question was regarding the foreign investors. Have they lost any chance whatsoever to immigrate to the States, having been swindled by these crooks?
Well, let me start first with the green card question, the second question you asked me. You know, we're urging all investors to consult immigration attorney because there are rights associated with these investments. And we've also been encouraging folks to refer to the immigration, the USCIS website. And if you go on our DFR website, if you are an investor, you can see all of the links and the email accounts for the federal program so that you can make those connections with the federal program. Because what we do is we are encouraging people to continue pursuing the appropriate immigration petition. As I said earlier, all is not lost. There's still jobs that were created up there. And we want to make sure that that investors follow the status of their pending green card.
We also got a note from a former Burke employee who says he feels like DFR, your department, is late to the investigation considering 180 layoffs happened a week before this became public. What will happen to those ex-employees, he asks.
My understanding is those layoffs were in great part seasonal, that were expected to be laid off because of, first of all, I think that the way it was described is not a great winter. So I think they were even laid off a little bit early. But I'm not part of that labor part of things. I'm just the cop on the beat. So that's as far as I can go with that answer.
I do want to point out that Vermont Edition is working on putting together a program, we hope for next week, that will take a look at what happens in the Northeast Kingdom now, what this means for the region, and what the impact of these allegations and the failure of some of these projects is likely to be for people who live and work in the Northeast Kingdom. So you can continue sending us your thoughts on that. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. And if you're interested in learning more about the allegations, both the SEC allegations and the state, and if you want to see more of the money trail, you can go to vpr.net. We have a link to the Department of Financial Regulation's website, the page where they have all of the information about the EB-5 fraud allegations. So go to Vermont Edition, click on our page for today. You'll find that link. It's also on our Facebook page. And I want to thank the Commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, Susan Don, again, for being with us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, although I'd rather be here for better reasons, but thank you very much for the invitation.
And coming up, we'll be talking with VT Digger founder Ann Galloway about her very in-depth reporting on this situation and on the EB-5 program that she's been doing for just a couple of years now. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've been looking at the state's role in bringing fraud charges against developers Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros in relation to large-scale projects they were building in the Northeast Kingdom with money from the federal EB-5 program. In addition to the state's suit is a federal suit bought by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Joining us now to talk about that and about the reporting she's been doing for several years now on this program and the potential mismanagement of it is VT Digger's Ann Galloway. Ann, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
So we've been talking with Commissioner Donegan about the state's lawsuit against Stenger and Quiros, but as I said, there's also this federal lawsuit. Do you have a sense of whether the feds knew more or knew it sooner than the state regulators? Did.
Yes, there's no question that the SEC was ahead of the game. It's hard to say exactly when the federal government got involved, but they started asking questions back in the spring of 2014. They interviewed a man named Joel Burstein, who was in charge of a local branch of Raymond James down in Coral Gables. And that's really, as I'm going through the documents, that's really the first instance I've seen so far in the exhibits that show when they started. And the SEC is very hush-hush about when they start, when they end, whether or not anything's happening at all. I can't tell you how much I've badgered them and how many no comments I've gotten from them. But, you know, they were collecting depositions basically as early as 2014. And even then, you know, with this particular interview with Joel, they get at some of the big questions, such as commingling of funds and the way Bill Stenger and Kairos coordinated the transfer of funds from People's Bank to Raymond James, and then the margin loans, and then transferring money back. All that, those questions are in that early deposition. So they were definitely ahead of the game, and the state came along a bit later. As Susan Donegan said, it was January 2015 before a formal investigation was started. But the state started asking questions back in May of 2014.
What would have tipped off the feds? Is it just because this is a federal immigration program that they would keep an eye on it? I mean, do you have a sense of how they got involved in the first place?
Well, I've interviewed some EB-5 experts who say that you know, it has to be pretty big for the SEC to get involved. Something like 1% of the complaints they get are investigated. That's what one EB-5 expert told me. So they must have been keeping an eye on this for a while, and I'm not sure what raised the red flags. There were red flags, you know, that kind of cropped up along the way. There was a guy named Michael Gibson, who is an EB-5 blogger, who raised questions as early as 2011. And then in 2012, there was that breakup between Douglas Hulme and Bill Stenger. Douglas Hulme was a partner in the J-Peak projects, and he announced in February of 2012 that he was concerned about the way the financials were being handled, and so that was a big red flag. He sent a letter out to about 100 immigration attorneys explaining his stance, and so that's kind of those were sort of the early flags. There were also some things that stood out from the beginning, such as, you know, the number of entities that Kairos had in the state of Vermont. He had lots of different companies, and that can be a sign that there's a shell operation going on.
Given those red flags that you just mentioned, and given that in 2014, federal regulators were looking into this, and starting in 2015, state regulators were looking into this, you know, a lot of people question why Governor Shumlin and other state leaders were still seemingly putting their support behind the EB-5 program and behind these particular developments for so long.
Yeah, that's a complicated question to answer. I think that there was a lot of reluctance to be critical of the J-Peak projects for a variety of reasons. One of the things that was difficult, I think, both for the feds and the state, was that there's no dispute that the projects were built. You know, in most cases, you had results. You had more people going to the Northeast Kingdom. You had an increase in jobs. I mean, I think it was in the summer of 2014, there was a big bump in employment in Orleans County, which had never happened before, and people were very excited about that. This is a very poor part of the state, and politicians have struggled for decades to find a way to bring jobs there. So I think there was a reluctance to draw back from that. Also, there'd been a lot of political capital expended on this thing, you know, all the way back to you know, Governor Douglas signing an agreement with ANC Bio back in October of 2009. In Korea, he went to Korea. There was Governor Shumlin's trip in 2013 to Asia. And, you know, Senator Patrick Leahy, of course, went to Shanghai in April of 2014. I think people wanted it to work. I think there was a lot of interest in supporting Stenger. It seemed like a miracle, and the miracle was sort of happening, and so people didn't want to question it. And I have to say, I always did, just because I'm kind of a skeptical person. But I think people were excited about it.
Well, you say, you know, some of the projects that were being built and were sort of coming to fruition in those jobs, but we should point out the Newport Renaissance project looks like it's not going to be built. This was supposed to be shops and other things that would bring people right down to Newport Center. ANC Bio facility sounds like that's completely off the table now.
That's
not going to happen at all.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And then there were some other projects that were taken off the table earlier, such as the Menk window factory that was scratched early on, the Newport Marina and Conference Center that disappeared when Tony Pomerleau decided he didn't want to have financial dealings with Bill Stanger. And then the airport is still up in the air a little bit. They were going to build a terminal, and then it was they weren't going to use EB-5 funds for it eventually, and who knows now what's going to happen with that. And then you also have Q Burke, which is not complete. They had a dream of really making that kind of an elite athletic center with an Olympic-sized pool and indoor and outdoor tennis courts and an indoor biking center. And in addition to that, you know, I think people don't realize that the stateside project at Jay Peak isn't complete. They were not able to finish the townhomes, and there, as far as I know, there's no money left for that either. And there was a plan to build a medical center and so on there as well. So it's not complete. On the other hand, the Northeast Kingdom has these projects, and I'm sure that it will continue to be a boon for the state in general, even though this is a very tragic and difficult situation. I think in the long run, those facilities will make a difference. The resorts were improved. So
we're talking with Anne Galloway. She's the founder of VT Digger, and she's been investigating the EB-5 program for a couple of years now and has done some really great reporting on what's been happening both in that program and now that the fraud has been revealed by the state and the federal government. And Bill Stanger had really the public image of a sort of an economic hero for the region, as you've talked about, that idea of bringing jobs, bringing commerce, bringing all of this tourism to the Northeast Kingdom. You know, that image is now in direct opposition to the reality of what we're seeing in these fraud allegations. Do you have a sense from your insight into these cases of whether Ariel Quiros and Bill Stanger are equally responsible here? Can Bill Stanger ever repair his reputation?
Well, I think there are two separate questions there. The first one is, you know, has to do with the allegations that have been posed by the SEC. And I think at this point, they've basically said that Ariel Quiros is responsible for actually stealing money, $50 million. That's the allegation. And then they've alleged $200 million in misuse of funds in which Mr. Stanger took part in. And I think depending on how things sugar off over time, we'll get a better sense of who was actually responsible. But I think that even now, if you look closely at the exhibits that have just been posted on the SEC website, it's pretty clear that Ariel Quiros could not have done this without Bill Stanger, even on a very practical level. Bill Stanger deposited the investor funds in accounts. The accounts were mirrored at the Raymond James Bank. And, he communicated with Mr. Quiros about transfers of funds. And so it's hard for me to believe he didn't know what was going on based on the documents that I've been looking at, including a letter from a former controller at Jay Peak who says to both Stanger and Quiros, look, you know, this is happening. We're commingling funds. Is that what we meant to do? This is after not being able to get access to the Raymond James accounts, because those were held by Ariel Quiros. And once he gets a hold of them, he finds that there's a problem, and that was in 2010. So clearly Bill Stanger knew about it back then. And you have to wonder how they could have started this from the beginning without Bill Stanger knowing. Because the money from investors was used to buy the Jay Peak Resort. And, you know, it's very clear that they used a complicated mechanism to do that. And I find it hard to believe that he wouldn't have known about it from the beginning. But, you know, the other thing about Bill is that, he's very articulate and people like him. And he was able to bring a lot of investors into the program. And, that's a kind of seduction. And so I think that they're equally involved.
We just have a couple seconds left, but I want to ask you as well about the state's role, because there have been a lot of questions and a lot of talk in the last few days about what did the state know when, what did Governor Shumlin know, and there have been some questions about email records in the governor's office and some people questioning whether or not they relate to this case. What do you know about that?
Well, the Shumlin administration has said that the emails that were going to be deleted really aren't important, and that there, if anything that had been related to the case had already been put on a litigation hold. And, you know, I guess my response to that is if that's true, then release the unimportant emails. What's the big deal?
Well, we'll have to see what happens with that. And more reporting to come, I'm sure, from Anne Galloway of VT Digger. She's been doing dogged reporting for a couple years now on the EB5 program and how it's been used and misused in the Northeast Kingdom. Thanks very much for being on Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
Tomorrow, we ask, what are the chances a seemingly impossible coincidence can actually be explained with math? It's all about things like probability, frequency distribution, and weak numbers. Mathematician Joseph Mazur will sort it all out for us, and we'd love to hear about the wildest coincidence that's ever happened to you. Email it to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.